what we can do using Monte Carlo to study string theory through the gauge residuality.
And this is the plan. So first, before going to rather technical stuff, I'd like to explain what can be done using Monte Carlo simulation method. And this part is rather my personal motivation. I want to explain what I want to do. And then I give a brief, very elementary introduction to Monte Carlo method. And tomorrow, and the day after tomorrow, I will explain actual simulation for supersymmetric gaming theories. And for a long time, until recently, Lattice Suzy was known to be not very, very difficult. In fact, even today, Lattice Suzy is difficult. And for simulation, we have to use some other method. But anyways, tomorrow I will explain the difficulty of Lattice Suzy and its cure using string-inspired methods and show some numerical results. So let's proceed to the first part. So what can be done using Monte Carlo simulation? So my starting point is this question: what is quantum gravity? There can be many answers. And one possible answer is, okay, superstring theory may give the answer. But the next question to come is, what is superstring? Did anybody give any non-perturbative definition for the theory? And unfortunately, the answer is no. But there are several proposals. And the most concrete one is ADS-CFT, or more generally, the gauge gravity duality conjecture. And I want to use this proposal. And in the celebrated paper of Maldacena on ADS-CFT proposal, in the concluding remark, he writes in this way: in principle, we can use this duality to give a definition of M string theory, blah, blah, blah. Notice that this is a non-perturbative proposal for defining such theories, since the corresponding field theories can, in principle, be defined non-perturbatively. So if we can define super M melts in non-perturbative manner, and if we can put it on computer, we can study superstring. But is it only of conceptual importance? This is not true. I want to make you convinced that it is a practical tool for explicit calculations. But some some quantity can be calculated more easily in string theory or Yamin theory depends on the quantity itself. But for some cases, supermelts is easier. For some cases, superstring or gravity is easier. So this is a cartoon for gauge gravity duality. And large N, strong coupling limit of supermelts corresponds to supergravity limit of superstring theory. And the large N but finite Hooft coupling corresponds to classical string. So supergravity plus alpha prime correction. Here alpha prime is the length squared of the string. And if we further go to finite N, then G string, which is proportional to 1 over N squared, appears, and it's really quantum string. And at this stage of the supergravity, is easier. So people usually use supergravity to study more difficult, large and strongly coupled supermelts. But once we consider string equations, I would say SuperMLs is difficult, but easier than these string theories. Then, in this case, use solving supergravity to learn about supermelt is a clever way. But if we want to study alpha prime or distinct collections, studying supermelts can be a cleverer way. But then how can we study the strongly coupled theory? The answer is Monte Carlo simulation. So this is why I want to apply Monte Carlo method to SuperMLs. So this is so as an example, I show some numerical results for one-dimensional or 0 plus one-dimensional SuperMLs, which is just the zero-brain quantum mechanics. And the action is given by this. So this is simply a dimensional reduction of four-dimensional n equals to 4 or n-dimensional n equals to 1 SuperMLs to one dimension. And here I didn't write coupling constant because coupling constant is dimensionful in this case, and we can always absorb it by redefining fields and coordinates. And the, if we put, if we Euclideanize it and compactify temporal direction and, for example, imposing anti-periodic boundary condition for fermions, then it corresponds, it describes thermodynamics of supermelts. And the temperature is 1 over beta, where beta is a circumference of compactified temporal circle. Then, conjecture by Maldacena is that supermelt thermodynamics corresponds to black hole or black zero brain thermodynamics. So this is a well-known dictionary of the correspondence. So ADM mass of the black hole in gravity side corresponds to energy density in supermelts. And the Wilson or Polyakov loop in supermelts corresponds to area of minimal surface which has these loops as boundary. And there is a famous GKPW relation which connects mass of field excitation in gravity side and the conformal dimension in supermelts. Here I could generalize because SuperMLs in one dimension is not really conformal, so conformal dimension is not really conformal dimension, so it's really similar to the one in CFD. And this is a simulation result. I hope after listening to these lectures you understand how to get this result and how to interpret this result. And so this curve. So this direction is energy divided by n squared. N is the size of gauge group. And this direction is temperature. And this curve is a prediction from supergravity. And in this model, strong coupling corresponds to low temperature. So supermelts should asymptotically go close to supergravity at low temperature. And these circles and the triangles are the simulation result. So it really goes close to supergravity result as we go to low temperature. And this difference between simulation result and the supergravity should correspond to alpha prime correction. And this dotted curve is fitting for the result. Using the known alpha prime correction. So we can calculate that. So leading supergravity result should be 7.4 times t to the 2.8. This is purely supergravity result. And we can see that correction, alpha prime correction, should behave as t to the 4.6. This value 4.6 can be determined analytically. And the overall factor in front of t to the 4.6 cannot be calculated analytically, at least at present, for the moment. Now, you know, detail of the alpha prime correction is not fully known, so we cannot calculate this number, but we can determine this power. So just leave this part as free parameter and fit the result. And then we see really nice agreement. If we take difference of simulation result and the supergravity curve and take log-log plot, then slope is really 4.6. So it suggests that alpha prime correction is greatly taken into account. And this is a simulation result by other groups, Cattrall and Wiseman. So basically, they calculate the same one. This curve is obtained from supergravity, and this direction is temperature. And as one goes to low temperature, simulation results go close to supergravity. So their result is consistent with ours. And also, we can calculate two-point function of certain class of operators whose conformal dimension can be calculated using Dubsack-Lebanov-Polyakov-Witten relation. And this is a two-point function in SU2 theory. It's the smallest possible n. And these operators, so I calculate the two-point function for two kinds of operators, which consist of scalars in one-dimensional theory. And they are predicted to behave in power law. And that power can be calculated analytically. This slope of these straight lines, these solid lines, are prediction from supergravity. And then the simulation results really agree, really behave with correct power. And surprisingly, correct power emerges already at SU2, although, you know, supergravity approximation can be justified only at large n. So, for example, in order to see how large one over n correction emerges, the easiest way, or perhaps the only way at present, is to use Monte Carlo simulation. So that's what we can do. And to explain how to get those results, I have to explain the basics of Monte Carlo. And this photo is this is a Monte Carlo in Monaco. I took this picture from Wikipedia. And this, you know, this town Monte Carlo is a really the name Monte Carlo simulation comes from this place, which is known for, you know, gambling place. And there are a few keywords. I think some of you already learned these words in undergrad lectures, and some people don't. And this is the guy who, you know, everybody knows, John von Neumann, who invented Monte Carlo method. And in the following, I introduced several keywords: Markov chain, detailed balance condition, important sampling, metropolis algorithm, dynamical fermion versus quench fermion, and sign problem. These are really, you know, technical words, but that's very easy. And once you understand it, you can understand what, you know, for example, lattice QCD people are talking about. The principle of Monte Carlo simulation is really simple. So let's consider field theory on Euclidean space-time with the action S of phi. This phi is a field. And in Monte Carlo simulation, we generate field configurations, a set of field configurations, phi, with probability proportional to e to the minus s on phi, which is a path integral weight. Then if you want to calculate the expectation value of some operator O, so this is a definition. This is just a definition of expectation value. Then if we can generate N configurations, this N is typically 100 or 1,000. And if we can construct field configuration phi labeled by I with this weight, this probability weight, then just taking average, we can approximate this formula. And if this N becomes infinity, this similar similarly equal becomes really exactly equal. And such a set of configurations can be generated using Monte Carlo method as long as exponential minus s is positive. Of course, in Euclidean spacetime, exponential minus s can be complex in general because of the weak rotation. But as long as this weight is positive, we can regard it as probability. And using Monte Carlo method, we can generate such configurations. And algorithm is simple, though why it works is, you know, to prove that we have to go through tedious calculations. If you are interested in after the talk, I can do that on the blackboard, but in this talk, I skipped that proof. Anyways, so start with some initial configuration, C of 0. So this C means configuration. And then generate a chain of field configurations by changing C0 slightly, then we get C1. Change C1 slightly, we get C2. Then such a chain of configuration is called Markov chain when transition probability from a kth configuration to k plus 1 configuration does not depend on previous configurations. And so we have chain, but you know, transition from C1 to C2 doesn't know anything about C0. In that sense, transition is a sort of random. And let's denote the probability of obtaining some specific configuration C at kth step to be WK of C. Then if this chain is Markov chain, then we have this relation, WK plus 1 of C is equal to WK C prime times transition probability from C prime to C and take sum over C prime. Because transition doesn't know anything about previous configurations. Only from kth configuration, we can get probability of getting C at k plus 1 step. Then, by choosing transition probability from C to C prime in a clever manner, so that when k is sent to infinity, this probability becomes proportional to e to the minus s. And in order to get this relation, obvious necessary condition is this. So just take send k to infinity in this equation, then wk plus 1 of c becomes exponential minus s. Wk of c prime becomes exponential minus s of c prime. And to satisfy this necessary condition, it's sufficient to impose a stronger condition, this one, exponential minus s of c times p from c to c prime equals to exponential minus S of C prime times P of from P from C prime to C. So here, you know, on right hand side we just add this symbol. On left side, you know, starting with C, in next step it goes to some other or the same configuration. So in this summation, of course, C prime equals to C is also included. Anyway, starting with configuration C, in the next step, we get some other configuration with probability 1, of course. So if we add some x sum over C prime here, it just becomes 1. So this relation is satisfied. So this stronger condition is called the detailed balance condition. And this is really important. And we also have some other conditions, ergodicity, which means for any configuration C and C prime, there's a finite transition probability with the finite steps as long as C prime has a non-zero integral weight. Otherwise, you know, we cannot, if this ergodicity is not satisfied, starting with some specific configuration, in actual simulation, we never arrive at C prime. Then, you know, if some configuration is excluded from the path integral, that cannot be a correct answer. So this condition is obviously needed if we want to approximate path integral measure using Markov chain. But the surprising theorem is, if a Markov chain satisfies detailed balance condition and this ergodicity, which is, you know, just a really natural condition, then this relation, which we want, is satisfied. And proof is tedious, as I can explain later. So there are many various algorithms, but essentially, algorithm is a choice of transition probability between two configurations. And the simplest one, and which is the basis of all other algorithms, is the Metropolis algorithm. This Metropolis is the name of this gentleman who was living in Illinois, I think. And there are various other stuff. For example, when we want to study include fermion in simulations, so-called hybrid Monte Carlo or rational hybrid Monte Carlo, are almost without these hybrid Monte Carlo or rational hybrid Monte Carlo, we cannot perform large-scale simulation with current resources. But anyways, these are just a technical improvement of Metropolis. So in the following, I explain what is Metropolis algorithm.
In the beginning, you must have used the hybrid or something because you had fermions.
Yeah.
And in the examples you gave at the beginning of the mm-hmm. talk, did you use the hybrid or the rational?
I use rational hybrid Monte Carlo. And in fact, first we are using hybrid Monte Carlo, and we use rational hybrid Monte Carlo, which is invented for large scale simulation. And the simulation becomes almost 1,000 times faster. And using hybrid Monte Carlo compared to Metropolis, the gain is 100 to 1,000, I think. So using better algorithm is very important, but it's really technical. So as the simplest example, consider Gaussian integral. So you can regard it as a field theory on one point and one field, x. And the action is really x squared divided by 2. And the partition function is this really well-known integral, which you learn in the first lecture in undergrad. So, Metropolis algorithm consists of two steps. First, vary the field x randomly. So, send x to x plus delta x. And this delta x runs from minus 0.5 to 0.5. Or if you like, you can take it runs from minus 1 to 1. But you cannot take minus 0.5 to 1, for example. So this interval must be symmetric with respect to the origin.
Size of the interval?
Yeah.
They want minus 2.
Size of the interval is arbitrary. Okay. But,
Okay.
And so first vary the field randomly and accept the new configuration with probability minimum of 1 and exponential to minus delta s, where delta s is the difference of the action. So, to get that, so you generate random number running from minus 0.5 to 0.5, and that's delta s. Then, you generate another random number, which runs between 0 and 1, and compare with this value. Then, so this procedure is called Metropolis test. And here I said accept. That means we update the configuration to new one, x plus delta x, with this probability. And we don't update otherwise.
Sorry, I do have the same question again. So why did you choose 1/2 interval?
You can write it as minus c to c.
Sure, but all alternatively, I can make change of
variable. Yes. But and in fact, by tuning that value, yeah, sometimes the convergence to the correct limit becomes faster, sometimes
there
slower.
There is no reason. There is no general theory that would allow you to figure out exactly which interval I should choose in order to speed up my...
In general, nothing. But of course, if you try several samples, then
sure,
you can see. And I just wrote the express value 0.5, because otherwise you may say, okay, minus c to c, what is c? Then, NODC is satisfied because, you know, x can go to x, value of x can increase, can decrease, and it's updated with some non-zero probability. So, starting with any x, you can go to any other x with finite steps, with finite probability. So, NODC is trivial satisfied. And what about weighted balance? So transition probability from x to x plus delta x, this one, is 0 when delta x is larger than 0.5, of course. And it's 1 when delta x is smaller than 0.5 and delta s is smaller than 0. And exponential to minus delta s when delta x is smaller than 0.5 and delta s is larger than 0. In the same way, transition probability from x plus delta x to x becomes like this. Okay, then we want to see this expression and this expression are the same in all three cases. It's easy to check. So in the first case, of course, this is 0, and 0 equals to 0, and that's it. And in this case, for example, when delta s is negative, then transition probability from x to x plus delta x is just 1. So this expression is exponential minus s times 1. And this is trivially equal to exponential minus s at x plus delta x times exponential plus delta s. But this is exactly transition probability from x plus delta x to x.
So the equation balance is satisfied in these things. And when delta s is larger than zero, completely the same way. You can see the equation balance is satisfied.
So am I imagine doing, do I imagine doing this for a particular choice of x, or am I doing this for a range of values of x?
So if you change the range of x, then, you know, only this part changes. But if you take, you know, delta x runs from, say, minus 1 to 2, then, you know, here, these two are not trivially related because, you know, going when delta x is positive, okay, you can go to farther x plus delta x, but you cannot go to far smaller than x.
But in the program, are you just telling it one particular value of x? X equals 0.2, x equals 10, I mean, or are you doing it for all possible values of x, or something in the middle?
For any x, this condition is satisfied, right?
Right.
So we take, say, x goes to 0 as the initial configuration.
Yeah.
Then just update value of x many, many times using this transition probability. That's it. Then it runs all possible x, of course. So we can start one particular x. That choice is obvious, in fact. But in the end, we go to the same, say, thermal equilibrium, which I will explain soon.
And in practice, do you choose initial value of x, like the settle point of your action? I mean, you mentioned that you would have chosen here x equals 0, right?
Yes. Well,
what if I would have chosen x equals 10? I could still generate configurations.
In fact, I will show the plot with the initial configuration condition x equals to 0 and x equals to 10. You see.
So, to understand that algorithm, let me show numerical example. So this is a value of x. So as initial configuration, we take x equal to 0. And then following the metaposition algorithm, we update or not update the value of x. Okay, then after, this is a plot of 5,000 steps. Okay, first x goes to positive region, but at some point it comes back and almost oscillates around 0. And if we make a histogram of a number of samples at the specific value of x, okay, in first 100 samples, distribution is very far from Gaussian. So here, first x became positive and oscillated in positive region. So this histogram has a larger distribution at positive region. But if we take if we study 1,000 samples, at some point it comes back to negative region. So distribution becomes closer to Gaussian. And if we take 10,000 samples, it's rather good. And if we go further, then it's almost exactly Gaussian distribution.
Values of x going between minus and plus a half, and the vertical axis is the number of times that x has that value. Is that
so? It's a density of the distribution of x.
So
using these say 1,000 samples, we take a histogram. So I divided x to small bins and counted the number of configurations which lies in that bin. And
so it's
made
the percentage of samples, basically?
Hmm?
Is it the percentage of
samples? Yes. So I counted the number and normalized it by, you know, dividing the total number. And that greatly converges to Gaussian weight, which is passing integral weight in this case. So if we prepare many, many samples, as long as we satisfy equidistance and detailed balance condition, this path integral measure converges to the correct one. So this is how Monte Carlo works. So then using many samples, just taking the average of observable, we can approximate expectation value rather nicely. So this is a history of x squared. So I have shown a history of x, but if we was the x squared, it oscillates like this. And this straight line is 1, which is the average or expectation value. And if you take average of these, you know, rapidly oscillating samples, you get this value. And this is a plot of average. So this is, for example, this point means average of x by using first 10,000 samples, for example. Then, if we increase the number of samples, average of x was the correct value, 0. And average of x squared was the correct value, which is 1. And here, I prepared really many configurations. But in typical Riemann simulation, using by using beta algorithm, reasonable results can be obtained just by using 100 or 1,000 configurations, as long as the theory does not suffer from sign problem, which I introduce soon.
And in the arrow, so it doesn't look like that the arrow converge, at least at the level of 100,000 steps.
First, I think the error is decreases like 1 over number of samples, 1 over square root of number of samples.
Right, but for the average of fat, it doesn't.
And compared from comparing here and here, expecting the difference is only, you know, 10 times. No, not 10. So here I see this number of samples 10 times. Then error decreases just 3 times. So it's really hard to see.
It doesn't look very convincing, but that's the average of x.
Because of this small difference.
Always negative.
Yeah.
Yeah. But in the end, it will converge.
So how do you know when you've got enough samples? Like here you know the answer, but how
yes.
do you know, if you don't know the answer, how do you determine when you've got enough samples?
So one easiest way, there's no general way to understand that, but one important criteria is here, for example, say take only first 100 samples, then what happens? If almost all eggs are in positive region, this is just because first in the first metabolic test, values go to positive region. Then after that, it remains in positive region for a while. And after some time, it comes back to negative region, right? So even though here we have hundreds of samples, they are not really independent. They are correlated. And so here, up to 1,000, essentially, number of independent samples is like 1, 2, 3, 4. That's it. Okay, so there's a way to measure that correlation. So it's not mathematically robust, there's a convincing statistical technique. And we can estimate number of independent samples. And if number of independent samples is, say, 100, usually it works. But it's really problem dependent, and there's no general way, I think.
Sorry. So in this case, since you know that the average of x squared is 1, right, so say a posteriori you measure the average of that 1, wouldn't that be an indication that you would like to make a sort of a step at least as big
you know, delta x, at least as big as 1.
Okay, okay.
So there must be something along these lines.
Okay, so if we change the interval, then, you know, sometimes correlation length becomes shorter, sometimes correlation length becomes longer. And we have to find best value which makes, which achieves minimum correlation length. So that we can get many independent configuration.
Right. In principle, it depends on the observable.
So yeah, in principle, yeah. And in practice, also, yes.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's a sort of numerical experiment. So unless we have some analytic result, it's really hard to say something. So even in lattice QCD, for example, people have some analytical result, and they confirm that they can reproduce that, and then they run that simulation and see whether their simulation result is correct. For example, they want to determine some value, but so like some constant terms times some function. That functional form is known. Then they can test if their result can be fitted by that analysis.
And once they can fit, they will trust that result. And that's the reason why it's not a politically correct statement, but what is achieved in lattice QCD is they can reproduce known result. But it's very hard to find something new, something with something not known. And the confusion, you can see that confusion in, for example, technical business. They are studying many flavor theory, which is different from QCD, but then they don't know whether how theory behaves because they don't have experimental input. Then the result is really controversial.
For gravity.
In our case, so we determine, we have some analytic results from string perturbation theory and compare them and determine new coefficient, which is not calculated from superstring.
Yeah. Just in those graphs there, that's reproducing the e to the minus x squared over 2.
Yes.
Right? So it's producing the integrand. It's not evaluating the integral.
But if you, once you generate this distribution,
yeah.
Okay, when you calculate observables, this one. So this distribution, so we take average over this with this weight. Right? So if you have a distribution with this probability weight, okay, this sum is replaced by this weighted, deweighted integral.
No, I understand that. It's just that I mean, the integral of Gaussian is a constant, root 2 pi, or whatever, depending on normalization. So you're reproducing the integrand here, after which you would add up all the histograms to get the area or something.
Yeah, and you can take any observable. Yeah, so you can calculate x or x squared, x cubed, anything.
But the output is this e to the minus s phi that you're getting. Is that the idea? I'm a little confused from the example as to what once I get this histogram with enough samples, what exactly is giving.
In Gaussian integral case, we have only one variable. You can easily like draw such distribution. Right. But in actual simulation, we have many fields leading us really many points. So we cannot, it's hard to visualize that distribution. So we get that distribution in principle in really higher dimensional space. But, you know, we don't have to care about that. We just taking average, we get correct depth. So what we do is really reproducing this distribution.
So here the histogram is just to tell us that it's doing a good sampling.
Yeah.
General.
But it's reproducing the integrand.
Finally.
Yeah. So what I'm trying to understand is that what you get out of Monte Carlo? You get the integrand of the action, or do you get more than that? And this example is too simple to see.
So we just average.
Average what?
Any observable, and that has all the same information. In this case, the observable is one.
And the Gaussian is the action.
Yes. Well, in this case, yes. And this is infant. So in this case, observable is x. In this case, observable is x squared.
Okay, alright.
And if we start with x equals to 10, we get this plot. So initial population is x equals to 10. But, it's living in x equals 10 is living in the tail of distribution. It's not important in path integral. So then, after a few steps, it comes down to zero, which is important, and oscillates only around zero. So in the, if you rely on the analogy to thermodynamics. So here, you start, the initial configuration is out of equilibrium, but quickly it thermalizes, and it oscillates only around thermal equilibrium state. And when we calculate the expectation value, we throw away these bad samples and take average only using these configurations. And after thermalization, configuration with small weight like this never appears in practice. So we pick up only important samples, important configurations. So for that reason, this simulation method is called important sampling. So in general, if we start with arbitrary configuration, almost always it goes close to some value uniformly. And after that, it starts to oscillate. And we can evaluate number of independent samples. And if we can see, for example, these configurations fluctuating some specific value for 100 independent samples, Yes. That's a very good question. And in fact, for example, in a superiamid case, we are interested in one specific saddle. The theory has really many saddles because it has moduli. And we choose initial configuration close to that saddle. Otherwise, it converges to other saddle. And in order to see our result is really in the our simulation captures really the saddle we want, we need other input, of course. We have to compare the result with some known physics. It's really experiment.
How to find saddles? I mean, if there was a double, like Mexican hat potential, and the second vector was at 12, then you would never see it in your simulation.
Yes, starting with here. But if you choose other initial configuration, which is close to another saddle, then you have a chance to see that.
Yeah, but the problem is really, as you said, when you have a moduli space.
Yes, and when it's not fixed.
Right, at least when you have separated saddles, then I can imagine,
Yeah, that's the treatment of moduli is really important and sometimes difficult. And it's in fact, for superimposed simulation, the most difficult part is that moduli problem.
Could you do it analytically somehow?
I think what people do in statistical physics is that they tend to look for large changes to the configurations which cost no energy. So you look for special configurations, and that's the type of thing. But it will switch you randomly through the moduli.
So it depends. So when you want to pick up all modular points, you have to do that. And when we inspect the one specific modular point, that's the case in Surprise Impact, then we have to see that the tunneling between modular doesn't happen. But once tunneling between modular happens, it's really easy to see. For example, in one
third of it oscillates like this, suddenly it jumps and starts to oscillate again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, but
and with continuous modular, it's impossible.
Okay, that was.
Yeah, in there, unfortunately, in my problem, modular is seems to be limited by quantum effect. In my case,
okay.
It's like zero plane.
If it was continuous, you would not want to separate. You would want to probe all.
Well, not clear. Again, depends when you measure observable expectation value of some operator, you probably want to measure it in a given vacuum. And you don't want to, you know, mix up different points in the modulus. And that's...
And also in super string context, that moduli is also very interesting because, for example, consider black hole phase, then through Hawking evaporation, it decays to thermal ADS, for example. That such a transition between two states contains interesting physics. So that point is really important. And it's a pioneer example that the modular problem really appears, and tomorrow I can explain in detail. And So far, I explained only simplest example without fermion. So let's see how fermion can be included. Once fermion is introduced, simulation becomes really expensive.
So in order to calculate, introduce fermion, okay, so we have bosonic part of the action and the fermionic part of the action. And the fermionic part is written in bilinear form, psi bar times Dirac operator times psi. Of course, we can have a four-fermion interaction, for example. But then we introduce auxiliary field so that action becomes bilinear in fermion. Then, if fermion appears in bilinear form, we can integrate them out by hand. And we just get determinant of Dirac operator. Then, this is just a bosonic theory with this effective action. Okay. Then we can generate bosonic configuration with this weight. And as long as S effective gives positive measure, and of course for that the determinant must be positive definite, as long as that is satisfied, we can repeat the same argument. The only difference is now we have to calculate determinant. So cost for calculating bosonic action in SUN gauge theory is n cubed times volume of lattice. This n cubed is really easy to understand because if you want to calculate the product of two matrices, you have to prepare three. You have to consider three indices. So Mij times M prime jk and ijk run from 1 to n. So cost of calculation is n cubed. And you have to calculate that product at each point. So in total, cost is n cubed times b. But to calculate the determinant of d, size of the Dirac is for fundamental fermion, nb times nb. And for adjoint fermion, which appears in supermodules, it's n squared b times n squared b. And to calculate determinant, cost is a cubic power of size of matrix. So in supermodule case, cost is n to the 6 times b to the 3. It's really huge. So for that reason, it's not easy to go to larger n or larger b. And we have to use clever algorithm. And because fermion is really expensive, here, you know, in fundamental fermion, which appears in QCD, this power is the same, but still power of volume is different. So simulation of fermion is really costly, And for that reason, until recently, in lattice QCD community, people used quench approximation. Here, quench is the same as probe approximation. And that means when they generate failed configurations, they neglect the effect of fermion. They just forget about this part and generate configuration using boson interaction. Of course, that's exactly in the Tofu-Flage energy limit, where NF is fixed, because then boson interaction is of order energy squared, and the fermion part is of order energy. But in super-MS case, you know, fermion contribution and the bosonic contribution cancels, and that cancellation is really important. So we have to take into account fermion appropriately. And such simulation is called, you know, dynamical fermion simulation. That means fermion is fully taken into account. And because in super-MS quench is not appropriate at all, we have to take into account fermion dynamically. And for that, we have to use clever simulation methods, which is developed in lattice QCD. And I spent almost an hour. So this is the last topic, sign problem. Once fermion is introduced, so-called sign problem can appear. So as I said, in Monte Carlo simulation, we generate field configuration with some probability weight. But probability must be real positive. And we know that sometimes life is not very easy. And when fermion is introduced in Euclidean signature, because of the after weak rotation, because of the weak rotation, we fermion determinant can become complex. And that can happen also in bosonic theory, when you have Chan-Simons term, for example. After weak rotation, Chan-Simons term becomes pure imaginary. So e to the minus s, it's simply complex. It's not probability. And when we introduce finite baryon number chemical potential to QCD, for example, after weak rotation, determinant is complex. And when you have Yukawa coupling to squawk, sign appears too. So in super-MS, there are many Yukawa couplings, so that causes sign problem. And such path integral measure cannot be generated by using Markov chain Monte Carlo method. So what people usually do is deweighting. That means first use another effective action where they ignore phase of the determinant. Then this gives positive definite measure, of course, by construction, and we can do simulation. And in order to calculate expectation value in full theory, where phase is correctly taken into account, okay, we use reweighting method. So first, this first equality is just a definition. This is a definition of expectation value of O. Okay, so here fermion is integrated out by hand. And then this determinant is, of course, absolute value times phase. So this part is just equal to this part. And here, in the numerator and the denominator, we insert the same factor, which cancels to 1, of course. And this is a partition function with this phase-quenched effective action. And this part is a expectation value of phase times observable in this ensemble. And the denominator is the expectation value of phase in this phase quench ensemble.
And very complicated now.
Phase is the phase of determinant. So it runs on unit circle. And it really lands violently.
So in compared to the operator O, which can be two-point function, this phase can be very complicated operator.
Very complicated.
It has to do everything.
I don't know how to write it down.
But numerically, you have.
Numerically, of course, we already have, or always have number. Okay, so this phase length expectation value can be calculated. And this equality itself is exact. So in principle, we can calculate expectation value in full theory. But usually weighting does not work in practice because this phase factor oscillates very, very violently. Then both numerator and denominator include the phase factor. And if this phase runs very violently from 1 to minus 1, they almost always cancel, and the phase becomes almost 0. It's really 0 within error bar. And then this expression is simply 0 divided by 0. It's nothing. So usually, phase length does not work. And there are another but related problem, which is called overlapping problem. So imagine that this curve is an integral measure of a phase point ensemble. So this direction represents field configuration, and some field has a larger weight, other field has smaller weight. Okay, and but it may happen that at this peak, this phase factor becomes really small. But it may be possible that at the tail, that cancellation is mild. Then, here cancellation happens. So, when we consider true integral weight, okay, so this peak just disappears because the cancellation phases. But this part can survive because of non-cancellation of phases. So, in fact, it's possible that the real integral measure is like this. And if these peaks does not have overlap, then because we are performing important sampling, in practice we never get the correct answer because say we have 100 samples, okay? There is hopefully at most one sample here, and 99 samples are here. Then we can never get correct answer for this distribution. That's the overlapping problem. So once some problem appears, usually people give up. But we will see miracles happen in superambles. That means in some cases, phase is really close to one. In some cases, phase factor in numerator and denominator simply cancel. And the phase quench can be exact. That's what happens in superambles. And also the similar can happen in QCD with baryon number chemical potential. So tomorrow I will apply Monte Carlo to superambles. And this is the last slide. This is I just listed keywords again. That's it. Thanks.
The miracle you mentioned, what is the tendency to do with supersymmetry? The miracle which you just mentioned, has it anything to do with supersymmetry?
For simulation? Yeah, for example, this example I have shown is one dimension of superambles. That's four dimension. And I explain how to get this result in one dimension, and also for two dimensional. There are several clever lattice formulations, and we can do simulation. In three and four dimensions, there are no convincing simulation results yet, but there are good proposals already, and I will explain. And tomorrow I have to introduce some other technical things about superambles simulation.
The configurations which you study, they are non supersymmetric, right? That was my confusion.
Okay. So, about same problem? Or which one?
You said about miracle. I thought for a moment it's related to supersymmetry, but I think you study non supersymmetric configurations. Is that right?
So, in supersymmetric simulation, we do this action. So this action is not supersymmetric because phase is not taken into account, right?
Yeah, but you said
and if we introduce, if we can take into account phase, that's a supersymmetric action, of course. And what happens is that supersymmetric treatment, which includes phase, and non-supersymmetric treatment, which does not take into account phase, give the same answer.
But your boundary conditions for thermions were anti-periodic. I thought you...
Okay, that's a finite temperature issue, right? So at finite temperature, so the theory itself is supersymmetric, but by boundary condition, by thermal effect, we break supersymmetry.
Perfect. But this breaking, does it influence this miracle or not?
That's a very good question. And if you go to very high temperature, for example, fermion decouples. Okay? And once fermion decouples, sign problem coming from fermion determinant goes away. And at low temperature, fermion becomes important, determinant factor becomes important. Then phase can become important. So at low temperature, where supersymmetry is restored, phase can become important. But it seems phase is not important at all, we can forget about that.
So
that's what I mean by miracle.
Okay, so you don't have any explanation for that miracle?
I don't have an analytic explanation, and the but numerically, we can show why phase can decouple. And I want to find an analytic explanation, but it's hard. And in QCD, at fine intensity, similar miracle happens. In that case, I know the analytic argument.
What's the basic idea for the hybrid Monte Carlo?
Hybrid Monte Carlo. In the case of hybrid Monte Carlo, so in Metropolis algorithm, we change the configuration really randomly. But in hybrid Monte Carlo, while satisfying ergodicity and detailed balance condition, they make a change of variables less random in the sense that once you're in the important sample, that's randomly generated new configuration is also in important region. In a,
so it increases the correlation?
I mean, here in Metropolis algorithm, okay, if you have many degrees of freedom, we really change each variable like this, really randomly. But then, almost always, you get no important sample. And almost always, that in Metropolis test, it's rejected. So, can I have For example, suppose you have make some apply. Then in Monte Carlo, in Metropolis, in user Metropolis algorithm, field can be random changes in this direction where action really increase and usually rejected by Metropolis test. Or it can move along this bound, right? And in hybrid Monte Carlo, somehow this change, which is almost always rejected, of course it can appear, but its probability decreases. So we, at each step, a new configuration is goes close to this value, which is important in path integral. Then, if in this simulation, new configuration is always rejected, then what happens is this correlation becomes long. And if you want to make the acceptance ratio bigger, then you have to decrease this delta x so that new configuration does not have large action, but then change of X is really small, so the same happens. Acceptance can be increased, acceptance ratio can be increased, but there is almost no change at one step, so there's huge oscillation. And in hybrid Monte Carlo, one can achieve that while, you know, making the step, like delta X, large, one can increase acceptance in Metropos test. And that's achieved because configuration moves around here, not go, try to go up.
But that's an improvement by a factor which has nothing to do with n or volume, right? The counting of n and volume is still the same.
Ah, that's the same. That's the same. But with the same amount of calculation, we can get many more independent samples.
So the counting is still the same, but here you get an efficiency gain of 100
yes,
or
yes.
something.
Yes, yes, yes. And in rational hybrid Monte Carlo, power also changes, and in typical situation, I think this n goes to n to the 5, I think, for example.
So effectively what you are saying, in the hybrid Monte Carlo, you adjust delta x dynamically.
Yeah.
In some sense. Yeah. Depending,
in some sense, yes.
Right. So when you reach equilibrium, you want to make delta x small, but...
No, even in equilibrium, we have to take larger.
Even in the equilibrium, there is an algorithm how you adjust delta x. Say, if I were to apply... Or maybe you can say, in a few words, suppose again, let's take the simplest example of the Gaussian integral. What would be the modification I would have to do to get a hybrid Monte Carlo and the rational Monte Carlo, or those are not?
So hybrid Monte Carlo can be applied to both cases in this case. Rational hybrid Carlo is compatible.
Okay.
And so in hybrid Monte Carlo, so here, you know, with Metropolis, you have only few independent samples. So this one. If you use hybrid Monte Carlo with the same step, it oscillates very rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And you have many samples. That's it.
So can you tell me exactly what do I do?
You convert it into a Hamiltonian dynamics. You add a P squared.
Yes,
Hamiltonian.
Yes.
Classical Hamiltonian dynamics. At the frictional momentum.
Okay. Yes. Exactly. But essentially, we do the same. This Metropolis test is the same. But this part, only this part changes. Only this part changes.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.